Well, it's still November for a few more hours, but lots and lots of people are anticipating the Christmas holiday. They'll be doing that this evening in Delhi Township. Lots of holiday spirit tonight with the Holt High School band, chorale, a tree lighting, reindeer from the Capital Area District Library. Santa will be there. It's their 21st annual tree lighting in Delhi Township at Veterans Memorial Gardens on Aurelius Road. That gets started at 6:30 p.m. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've got Current State on WKAR. November was packed with important Michigan news. Recounts notwithstanding, a Republican presidential candidate prevailed for the first time in the state since 1988. A Michigan native has been nominated for Secretary of Education, and much-debated energy legislation moved forward at the state capitol. Let's unpack November with two guests. Emily Lawler covers Michigan government and other news for MLive. Welcome back, Emily.
Yeah, thanks.
And Zach Gorchow reports on the state at Gongwer News. Hi, Zach.
Good morning.
We'll presumably learn today about a presidential vote recount in Michigan launched by Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein. Now, the costs of such an endeavor is all over the news here today. Some say it could be exorbitant. Zach, who is saying what here?
Well, the state officially will charge Jill Stein $125 per precinct, which they are estimated to be just shy of $1 million. However, the Secretary of State, Ruth Johnson, is saying the actual costs are likely to be at least double that. That will come out of the taxpayer revenues. The Michigan Republican Party is all over this recount, criticizing it as a total waste of time, given the extreme unlikelihood it would change the result. And they're saying, hey, if a statewide election costs $10 million, why would this hand count of all the ballots cost less than
that?
Cost
a whole lot less, exactly.
Yeah. So the total started at $790,000 is what initially the state thought it was going to charge Jill Stein's campaign for this recount. That went up a little bit based on, I guess, some absentee precincts that were discovered. But, you know, the estimates are ranging, you know, like Zach said, up to $10 million. So the Stein campaign will cover a portion of this, but the taxpayers are going to cover the rest.
Let's listen to a couple of prominent voices here, both for and against the recount. Here is GOP State Chair Ronna Romney McDaniel criticizing it.
This will cost our taxpayers, it will cost our counties, it will take time, it is disenfranchising our voters, and it is an outrage.
And here is Attorney Mark Brewer, former Democratic Party official, defending the recount idea.
Democracy is priceless. The integrity of our elections is priceless. And if one vote was not counted properly, that should be taken care of and fixed. And that's what this process is all about in the end.
So assuming Jill Stein does pursue the recount, what is going to happen when, Zach? How is this going to unfold?
Well, I believe the state has said, and it would be the state of Michigan that oversees the recount, that it would start the recount in the largest counties on Friday. And basically, they'd work straight through with the goal of getting it done by December 13th, because by law, Michigan's 16 electors are supposed to convene in the Michigan Senate chambers on December 19th to cast their votes. So you need to leave some cushion for legal challenges once the count is done. However, once, presuming Jill Stein does file for the recount, there are 7 days to file an objection to that. So there's a lot of stuff that could happen yet.
Let's go a little bit deeper there. How could a recount be stopped?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the first level is that the Republican Party or the Trump campaign could challenge that and try to get it stopped kind of at the administrative level. But
they'd have to appeal to the Board of State Canvassers, according to Fred Woodhams, who commented on this earlier this week from the Secretary of State's
office. And that's a split board. It has half Republicans and half Democrats. But, you know, that said, I think Republicans have had pretty good luck before that board in the past several years. So, but, you know, there's other ways. One of them, of course, would be a legal maneuver. There is some precedent, I guess, in the 2000 race down in Florida for kind of getting this to stop at a certain date. And then the other thing is just time. You know, if they run out of time, at some point the Electoral College, is going to meet on December 19th. And that's a pretty hard deadline for when this recount would have to be done by.
About 10,000 votes separated Donald Trump from Hillary Clinton here in Michigan. In the other states where recounts are being pursued, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. There was a 70,000-vote gap in Pennsylvania, a 20,000-vote gap in Wisconsin. Collectively, that's three stars that kind of have to align for any practical impact here, for any practical benefit for the Democrats, with the chances of a reversal apparently minuscule. What might the Democrats gain from this endeavor, Zach?
My silence is probably deafening right now. You know, this is a lot of people would say this is a vanity effort by Jill Stein, an extension of a campaign that might, you know, have been a vanity effort. And to many Democrats would say cost Hillary Clinton the election.
I've heard other people say, though, that this is more publicity for the Green Party and the left.
Exactly.
Just because of that, then she probably got in the general election as a candidate for president.
I believe she's actually raising more money for this effort than she raised in the general election. Yeah. So,
I mean, this all started out of a very suspect, quote unquote, news article that raised the specter of tampering in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania with the vote totals. There's been no evidence of anything like that, just a lot of supposition, but that basically got the ball rolling for the Green Party to say, well, let's have a recount and see if there was in fact any funny business going on.
And oh, how the tables have turned here!
Exactly.
Because you know, during the campaign, Trump supporters were saying we're not sure we can trust the results.
Right.
Trump himself was up there saying he wasn't sure if he would accept the results unless he won. I guess that was a later disclaimer after the third debate. But you know, and Democrats are basically looking at them saying, "You people are crazy. Our election system can't be hacked. You know, a lot of these machines aren't even connected to the internet." Are you really supposing that someone could be paid to go in and hand tamper with, you know, thousands and thousands of precincts? And now it's Republicans who are saying, are you crazy? There's no way that in Michigan a 10,000-vote margin is going to swing the other way.
Emily Lawler of MLive, Zach Gorchow of Gongmer News here on Current State's Month in Review for November. Let's move to the lame duck session of the Michigan legislature, which began yesterday. Lots of chatter here about what we're apt to see, probably more about energy legislation than anything. Zach, remind our listeners, what's in front of the State House here? It's complicated,
yes.
But do your best.
All right. So the utilities, for some time, entities like DTE Energy and Consumers Energy have wanted a big change in the overall energy legal climate. They want more requirements for the alternative electric suppliers. These are entities that have a set limit of 10% of the market. The big utilities say, hey, look, you know, we have to take care of the grid for these people. You know, we have, you know, sometimes their customers come back to us. We have no way to plan around it. They want mechanisms in place to deal with that. The bill as it stands right now would increase the mandate on the percentage of fuel that has to come from your renewable sources from 10 to 15%. And it would set up a whole new process for the create regulatory scheme and creating new power plants.
Yeah, it's kind of an overhaul is how I've been referring to it. It has a lot of regulatory implications at the Michigan Public Service Commission level that that's the state agency that regulates utilities, and also some renewable implications, and kind of sets the direction that the state's energy future is going to go in here.
All of that said, there is significant support for this. Clearly, it cleared the Senate. Republican State Rep. Gary Glenn of Midland was here on Current State on Monday. Here's a little bit of what he was thinking then. He is an opponent.
I don't know what our odds are going in, but I do intend to seek significant amendments or try to stop it and wait a month and work with a new Republican administration in a new environmental climate.
And presumably he's referring to the future of the EPA under Donald Trump's appointee or maybe the reconfigured Michigan House. It could be either or it could be both. What do we know? I mean, the session just got started yesterday. What do we know about what's happening in the House Energy Committee right now?
Well, the bill's never going to make it to the House Energy Committee. They've decided to keep it on the floor of the House, which is, I think, a move to sort of prevent a core of pro-customer choice Republicans led by Mr. Glenn from causing problems for it in the committee. So it stays on the floor. That's where the game is right now.
This is a very interesting development.
Yeah, and you know, the House Energy Policy Committee had already passed its own version of what it wanted energy policy to look like going forward. And they took months and months of hearings. So it's not as if they're not briefed on the issue, but the fact is it won't go through that committee process, which means there won't be an opportunity for more public input.
This is a move by Speaker Kevin Cotter?
Yes, it's his decision. I'm sure it was made in consultation with Eric Nesbitt, who is both the chair of the Energy Policy Committee
yeah.
and the majority floor leader of the House.
And we should expect, I mean, where's the smart money on this thing?
Well, I think the expectation is it will pass at this point. It's all, basically the question is, will the Republicans adhere to this rule where half of their caucus has to be behind a controversial piece of legislation? I think most people think if you put this bill up for a vote, it would pass. But there's been reticence about, say, passing something with minority Democratic votes and a handful of majority Republican votes. But I think the expectation is that it passes.
While we're on the legislative agenda, the topic of term limits came up again this month. It does pretty routinely here in Michigan, and that would be easing term limits. This was courtesy of our Republican state rep, Ed McBroom of the UP. Emily, what's going on?
Yeah, McBroom has essentially thrown some proposals on the table that range from, you know, completely eliminating term limits to reducing them to instituting some sort of a waiting period. You know, these are all options that have been bantered about in political circles for a while. And I will say that you said it, that we've heard some of these things before, and we tend to hear them in December, especially as the session is winding down and lawmakers are you know, getting ready to get out of town. But I don't see this being a huge push, and I also don't see it having a ton of grassroots really support. Obviously, Michigan voters voted for term limits. And, you know, I haven't heard from my readers, at least, any sort of a groundswell of a desire to eliminate them.
It would seem that the public might be skeptical of a proposal coming from the legislature, enabling them to stay in office longer.
Correct. You know, term limit reform is like the Bigfoot of legislation in Michigan. It's like always talked about, but never actually materializes. You know, this, as Emily said, right on point. This happens pretty much every 2 years in the lame duck session, because there are legitimate problems term limits causes. There's no question about it. But it's kind of a boutique issue. As Emily said, it is not something that has really galvanized the public, despite I think some high profile problems that term limits has contributed to. And how the legislature operates. There just seems to be no groundwork laid for this to happen now, and it would be a big surprise to me if it got traction.
Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News, Emily Lawler of MLive, it's current state's Michigan Month in Review. When I left here yesterday, I know I wanted to talk about the proposals for 401k-style retirement plans for Michigan educators. It turns out this morning we learned that the Senate is all set to vote to close the pension system to newly hired school employees and instead provide them solely a 401k in retirement. The chamber plans to approve the plan today once it clears a committee. Could you remind us what the basics are of this?
Yeah, essentially a few years ago, the legislature established what is now called a hybrid system for teacher retirement, meaning that new teachers were hired in at a plan that was a very small or a smaller pension or defined benefit plan plus a 401k style defined contribution plan. And, you know, some people, including the governor, think that's been working pretty well. However, there's a push from Republicans in the legislature to revisit that and maybe say, let's close the pension portion altogether. And instead of that, put everyone into a 401k style plan.
Proponents say this would beef up the finances. It would eliminate deficits in the future.
Right. There's a unfunded liability in the system. And they see this as, you know, going to a full 401k system as a way to deal with that and cut down on the unfunded liability. I mean, you see school districts continue to have to contribute a large portion of their budgets toward funding the pension plans. The state continues to contribute escalating amounts of money to pre-fund the pension plans, and the Republicans in the legislature see this as a way to curb that.
Donald Trump has appointed Betsy DeVos, a Michigan resident, to be the country's next education secretary. There's already been a lot of response to this, centering basically around Ms. DeVos's longstanding support for school choice and vouchers. But briefly, share your two cents worth here, Emily. What do you make of this?
Yeah, you know, I think it's an interesting pick on Trump's part because DeVos has a long history of education advocacy, but not necessarily a history of being involved in actually educating students. So I think among the education community, there are some very real fears because to some extent she's untested on a lot of issues, but for the public school community, the issues she is tested on, like vouchers and charters, are ones they don't agree with.
Yeah. Were you surprised by the pick, Zach?
Well, you know, I don't know that you could. I'm just not surprised by anything right now in the wake of the Trump election. I mean, anything is possible. But, you know, her worldview on education does align with what he talked about during the campaign. So in that sense, it's not surprising. You know, clearly he's taking a new sheriff in town approach. You know, this is somebody, President-elect Trump, who talked about, do we need a Department of Education at all at the federal level? So there's clearly going to be a lot of potential to expand what the federal government does to bolster school choice, charter schools. Would the federal government try to do something to have aid for students with that are going to private K-12 schools? Who knows? It's all on the table. That's pretty much what I thought of it.
Zach, have you followed this Wolf ruling with the along with a term limits discussion? You can also expect some other some other ruling involving wolf hunting here every few years in Michigan. We had one this month.
Yeah, it was the old title object clause of the Michigan Constitution, which says that a bill cannot basically embrace more than one purpose. Maybe the most toothless provision in the Michigan Constitution, usually roundly flouted with no legal consequences. Finally, the Michigan Court of Appeals decides, hey, you can't do that with this law. It said, well, there's a piece of this bill that essentially authorized the ability for a wolf hunt that embraced a different purpose. They threw the whole thing out. I suspect this is going to go to the Michigan Supreme Court, and this isn't the final word on it. But for the time being, it has taken away the legal authority for a wolf hunt. Of course, the federal government put the wolf back on the endangered species list, so that's been suspended anyways.
Basically, this gave the Natural Resources Commission and the legislature the authority to determine what animals could be hunted or otherwise.
Yes.
And this sent it in the other direction. Emily, going on 3 weeks ago now, a federal district judge in Detroit ruled that the state or the city of Flint, one or the other, or both, is on the hook to Flint residents impacted by the water crisis more than in the past. What did Judge David Larson rule exactly here?
Yeah, well, speaking of court rulings, he agreed with the plaintiffs who had argued that the state and the city should be delivering water to Flint residents, not just establishing these distribution centers where you can come and get water. The arguments are basically that some people aren't mobile or aren't able to get to such a distribution center. The state can't definitively prove that every resident who needs one has a filter. And at this point, Flint residents are still drinking filtered or bottled water. And the desired delivery amount, I believe, is 4 cases per day per person.
And how did state government respond to this, Zach?
Well, I believe they are appealing. They're saying it would take a Herculean effort to pull this off. It would require diverting other Flint resources.
$140 million price tag, I believe.
It would require diverting resources from other Flint water efforts to this. So they are fighting it at this point.
We want to thank both of our guests, Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News, Emily Lawler of MLive. It's been Current States Month in Review. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And coming up on Current State, for Neighbors in Action this week, we're going to learn about the Hispanic Latino Commission of Michigan from its relatively new executive director, Felipe Lopez Sustaita. That's later this hour on Current State. Sometimes you can tell where a person is from by the way they talk, and there's a new book exploring the phrases and accents that you hear in the Midwest and nowhere else. Author Edward McClelland considers these regionalisms in his newest effort, How to Speak Midwestern. Scott Wohl talked with Edward McClelland. Does he mean for the book to be comical or academic or both? What?
Well, Mark, you will laugh at times when you're reading How to Speak Midwestern, but Edward McClelland tells me he took the project quite seriously.
I think one of the first people who read it said it would appeal to people who are looking for the intellectual or the linguistic underpinnings of Midwestern speech, but also for a general audience who wants to be entertained. And I tried to work some ethnography and history into the definitions. So I suppose how to understand Midwestern might be a more accurate description of what I was trying to accomplish. It's kind of hard to fake an accent, although many actors try it.
In your book, you cite some general rules for speaking Midwestern, and I'd like to go through them briefly. There are things like talk through your nose, draw out your R's, omit vowels, mispronounce foreign names. A couple I really like, pop, not soda. I couldn't agree more.
Okay.
And say, you guys.
Sure. Those are all good ones.
Now, there's one that we want to spend a moment talking about, though, and that is when you're criticizing someone or something, you do so passive-aggressively. This might bring people to mind of Minnesota Nice. But
exactly.
Is that part of it, though?
Yeah. Well, I can read you the passage here.
Sure.
And if you must criticize, do so passive-aggressively. It's been said that in New York, every insult is a compliment. In the South, on the other hand, every compliment is an insult. Well, aren't you kind? In the Midwest, you're never certain whether you're being complimented or insulted. Midwesterners don't like to sound critical or hurt anyone's feelings, so we've developed code words that allow us to avoid stating an opinion altogether. The most important words to know are interesting and different. If something has merit, but you don't personally care for it, it's interesting. What do you think of the Vikings' new stadium? It's interesting. Or what do you think of that mural under the Wilson Avenue viaduct of three dolphins making love with the Queen of the Nile? And it's pretty different. And later on in the book, I talk about a New York Times article about the movie Fargo and the reaction to it in Minnesota. And the author quoted an older gentleman coming out of the movie and saying, well, that was different, which is probably about the most damning review you can get in the Midwest.
I'm glad you brought up Fargo. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about Fargo. You spent some time in Minnesota doing some research, including a conversation with Larissa Coconut. She's a native Minnesotan, and she's
right
in Fargo. She plays a prostitute in the movie. Off-screen, though, she also worked with star Frances McDormand on her accent for the film. I'm going to play a clip from that scene, and a heads up here for listeners. There's an anatomical reference here that could require explaining to a younger listener.
Okay. I want you to tell me what these fellas look like.
Well, the little guy, he was kind of funny looking.
In what way?
I don't know, just funny looking.
Can you be any more specific?
I couldn't really say. He wasn't circumcised.
Was he funny looking apart from that?
Yeah.
They sort of exaggerated the forwardness of the Minnesota accent for comic relief in the movie. They like the contrast of you know, these very nice, agreeable people and the dark side of the story, all the murders that were going on. I'll tell you what she said about working with Frances McDormand. We talked about nodding, being agreeable, and wanting agreement. It's that Norwegian thing of, we're not going to get through these winters without working together. And then the O sounds like a no. We talked about the musicality of it going back to Norwegian and then how it flattens out a bit. It's very forward. It comes out of the top of the mouth. we talked about the Ya, because the Ya lives in the same place. So when I went to Brainerd, I didn't hear anybody who you could really say had a Fargo accent. But then when I listened to oral histories in the county historical society, you could definitely hear older people who did talk that way.
We're talking with Edward McClelland about his new book, How to Speak Midwestern. People like you and me who grew up in Michigan, we, of course, don't have an accent, right?
That's what all Michiganders want to believe. I actually had a linguistics professor who got his degree at the University of Michigan, and he made that point distinctly, is that people in Michigan think they don't have an accent. And they were very confused as to why he was doing this linguistic research on the way they talked. But he was researching the northern cities' vowel shift. Studying that is actually what led me to write the entire book. And that's a change in vowel pronunciation, which is said to be the most significant change in English vowel pronunciation in 1,000 years, and which is heard sort of along the lower Great Lakes from Rochester, New York to Milwaukee. And some of the signature sounds, which you will hear all over Michigan, are things like the word C-A-N sounds like can, a raised A, the word B-O-X comes out sounding like box, which is called a fronted O, and then S-E-V-E-N can come out sounding like seven. So there are vowels that are sort of all shifting into different positions throughout the spectrum of vocabulary. And it's made Michigan's speech distinctive enough so that it was actually parodied on Saturday Night Live. 20 years ago, there was a skit called 1-600-Lansing, about a phone sex line for men who just love women with nasal Michigan accents.
Hey, my name's Barbara.
Hi, Barbara, this is Mark.
Hey, thank God for spring, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, Mark, let's get started.
Oh, yeah.
How often is Lansing ever mentioned on Saturday Night Live?
Not often.
Right. So I think that there was a time when Midwestern speech was sort of considered standard American English. This was in the 20s, and there was a professor at Hiram College in Ohio who put together a pronunciation guide for NBC. And of course, since he was in the Midwest, he thought Midwestern speech should be the standard. And one of the things that he established that really has become part of standard American English was using your R's. You can go back and hear old newsreels or old actors where they're dropping their R's, which is called non-roticity. And he said, always pronounce your R's. And so that sort of affected mid-Atlantic accent that you'd hear people like Katharine Hepburn or William F. Buckley or George Plimpton use has really gone out of style. And now it's pretty standard to say all your R's.
We need to speak a moment about the distinctive way that people in Michigan's Upper Peninsula talk, eh?
Sure.
You call it Youpanese.
Well, you know, Youper is actually a pretty a term of very recent vintage. It only dates back to the late 70s, and I think as the Upper Peninsula became more connected to the rest of the state and the rest of the country, people wanted a word that expressed their distinctive identity. So in 1979, the Escanaba Daily Press held a contest to name the inhabitants of the UP, and Youper was the winning entry. And I think a couple of reasons why speech there is so distinctive is, number one, it was so geographically isolated, and number two, because it was settled by Finns who spoke. Finnish is a language that's completely unrelated to English. It's not even Indo-European. So they had a harder time switching into English than other immigrant groups would have. You know the movie Escanaba Into Moonlight?
Sure.
Then there's that comic band, the Youpers, and saying duh instead of the is actually common in places where there's a lot of immigration because TH is a pretty unique, almost unique to English. Very few languages have the TH sound. And it's a major player in our language, so when people came over, they had trouble putting their tongue through their teeth and making that sound. So they would just stop at duh or them or those. And so you'll still hear people in the UP talk like that. Tom Izzo is a Uper speaker, and he has some elements of Upanese in his speech, but he's been in the Lower Peninsula for so long that unless you're really listening for it, you're probably not going to hear it too much.
Edward McClelland will talk about his new book, How to Speak Midwestern, at Everybody Reads in Lansing, Saturday at 1 p.m., and at the Charlotte Community Library at 6:30 p.m. next Tuesday. Great talking with you again.
You too.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And you'll find a few highlights from Edward McClelland's Michigan-based Glossary of Terms in bonus audio at WKAR.org. Coming up on Current State, the world is full of sounds, but how much do we listen to them instead of just hearing them? A retired Michigan State University professor takes us into the woods to listen to what nature has to say. Current State's Kevin Lavery reports on the science of ecoacoustics coming up in a few minutes. And we can't talk about the Upper Peninsula on this final day of firearm deer hunting season without hearing a bit of the second week of Deer Camp by the Upers. Here they are.
It's the second week of Deer Camp, and all the guys are here. We drink, play cards, and shoot the bull, but never shoot no deer. The only time we leave the camp is when we go for beer. The second week of Deer Camp is the greatest time of year.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR, three times daily, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM, and every weekday at noon on AM 870, and we're here on the weekends as well with Current State Weekend. How might Michigan reduce the high school dropout rates of its Hispanic youth and enable more Hispanics to get better job training and post-secondary education? Those are the goals of the Hispanic Latino Commission of Michigan. It's a division of LARA, the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs. The commission strives to market the state's career development services to Michigan's Hispanics. Over the summer, it appointed a new executive director. He joins us today for Neighbors in Action, Dr. Felipe Lopez Sustaita. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Why was the commission created?
So the commission was created back in 1975 when there was concern residents in Michigan from Flint, from Saginaw, from Detroit, and different areas. They all came together and they felt there was a void that needed to be addressed. And so the governor at the time, back in July 15, 1975, the governor signed the Public Act of 164, and it was to create a commission so that they could address some of the issues that Hispanic Latino population was dealing with.
Been around 41 years.
41 years.
Yeah. The commission wants to increase economic stability and economic growth for Hispanics. Talk to us a little bit about how you try to do that.
Yes. So the first thing since I currently started back in July, the first thing was to go out there and talk to folks, go out into different parts of the state. I've traveled up to Traverse City, to different parts, Holland, to Grand Rapids. I've met with people in Detroit, in Flint, in other rural areas, and just talking to communities, going Adrian, Michigan, you know, just going and talking and hearing what the concerns are. And what I've realized is that they all have different issues, different concerns. And so for me, it was basically to formulate a plan on how to address some of these issues, because they all have, again, different populations as well. When you look at a Saginaw, there's less Spanish speakers than there is in the southwest of the state. So understanding that was a priority for me. And I think now me and there's 15 appointed commissioners by Governor Snyder. And so they help me in the different regions. And so they allow me to, you know, to hold meetings or to introduce me to some of the political people that are in those regions.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that was the first thing, and that's in the stage that we're currently trying to wrap up so that we can start creating an actual plan so that we can address some of those issues.
Economic stability. Yeah. Education has to be a big part of this as well. What are you hearing in your travels? What particular, tell us a few things that you've heard or that you've been hearing.
Well, there's a lot of things that come to mind. I think the relationship with law enforcement and you know, from our part, we're trying to connect and build that bridge in different cities. You know, by talking to the mayor of different cities, and it's been great. And some cities have done a better job. For example, in Holland, they hold meetings where police officers and community members, you know, try to bridge that relationship in Grand Rapids. And I think those are models for that certain issue. But there's others. I mean, we're dealing with dropout rates, both in high school and dropout rates in universities and colleges. And so it's very large issues, and we cannot do it alone. So we rely heavily on partnerships at universities. So I spend time, you know, going and meeting with presidents and seeing what are the mechanisms that are there to help support some of our community members, especially since the demographics are shifting and we're seeing that 1 out of 4 children are Latino. So we want to make sure that we make some progress so that, you know, we don't have a very, very large population that is not, you know, being taken care of. So
Do you link the dropout rate with tension with the police?
No, not just, I mean, it's a multitude of things. I think, you know, there's issues like myself as a migrant worker where we're moving around. I mean, there's issues too of misunderstanding. Maybe sometimes parents work a lot and there's not enough, and also not enough role models, like as teachers. I mean, sometimes I believe that if you can't see it, you can't be it. And so that whole philosophy, and I think we have an obligation as a commission to also, you know, help some of our college graduates get jobs, be in government, and so that there's more voices talking about. So there's a multitude of things. I don't think it's just the police issues that we have, or the prison issues. We have a lot of Latinos in prison to a high rate. And so, you know, young people growing up without their father in their life, there's families that are being, you know, pulling apart by, you know, immigration issues where people are deported, parents. You know, we had not too long ago, we had an influx of young people in the border. And many ended up here in Michigan through the foster care system. So there's a lot of, it's very complex. And so that's the things that we're also mandated to do research. And that's what we're trying to do, to educate not just our constituents, the people that we serve, but also the legislators and our state reps, so that they understand some of the issues.
Understood. You've said that you've been traveling the state here since July, since you came into your position. The idea is to put some kind of framework on the table then?
Yes.
From these discussions?
Yeah.
What would that framework, tell us more about that. What do you want to create exactly?
Yeah, I think it's like everything. I think I was in higher ed before I came here, and a lot of times we work in silos. So the academic side and the student services side, and then you have all other things that never work together. And I think that's the way I see us, you know, and talking about sports analogy, almost like a point guard, getting all the pieces together. Because I think issues are very similar in different regions. And I think if we can facilitate a way of bringing people together, even here in Lansing, and talking about these issues and supporting one another, I think that's the way we're going. We want to make sure that we come together more often and that we listen to each other. And I think learn from other communities that are doing great work so that others that are struggling can.
Do volunteers play a role in the work that you do?
Definitely. And like I said, I just started, so I am going to be having opportunities for college students, for community members, maybe that are retired. And I'm already facilitating that with folks, you know, retired professors that I've met with that are interested in doing something, but also college students and community members. They're going to play a pivotal role since our department, I mean, it's only me and a graduate student. So definitely, and we already started that work. We had a backpack drive in Flint, Saginaw, and here in Lansing. And in Flint, it was led basically by community members who raised a ton of backpacks and supplies for families.
Well, people looking for a volunteer opportunity may be having one, or there may be more in the future. I take it from the Hispanic Latino Commission of Michigan. We've just scratched the surface here, Felipe, but we'll have you back. There's a PhD after your name, and you come from a family of migrant workers. So I'd like to learn more about your story here at some point. I've been speaking with Dr. Felipe Lopez-Sustaita, the executive director of the Hispanic Latino Commission, a division of the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs. Lara, Felipe, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Mike.
And Current State is looking for more nominations for Neighbors in Action. Help us out. Email us a suggestion to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line. Tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. It's Current State on WKAR. How many times has it been said there's a difference between hearing and listening? Just as a doctor listens to a heartbeat to study a person's health, the sound of our physical environment can give us some clues about its status. That is the science of ecoacoustics. Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now with more, and it's cats and birds and people talking, all of these things and more. It's this mix of noises that tells us about how healthy the planet is that fascinates researchers. Kevin spoke with Dr. Stuart Gage, a Michigan State University professor emeritus. They met bright and early a few days ago in a wooded area of Meridian Township, where Dr. Gage has a series of sensors that record the world around us 24 hours a day.
I come here quite often in the morning to just enjoy the forest and walk the dog, and I've had four sensors here, so about once a month I come and change the batteries and listen to the sounds of the place. These four places are in the forest, but at the edge of the wetland. You can see over there, there's a young deer hopping away there. There's a big wetland right here next to the road, which you can hear the cars coming by here. Technophony.
Technophony is your word.
Right, technophony. It's the sound of things that humans make that make noise. So it's usually planes and boats and trucks and cars and jet skis and all those sort of things.
A mix of technology and cacophony.
Righto, righto.
We just got a visit up close from a bee, and we can hear the birds as well. So without looking at your sensors right now, just listening with the naked ear, if that's the word for it, what can you tell about our environment, given your training?
You can get all kinds of things. You can tell which species of birds are in the environment. You can tell when the dawn chorus is happening. You can tell when the dusk chorus is happening. You can tell about the arrival of birds in the springtime and the leaving of birds in the fall. You can measure ecological health. If you look at different metrics, measure biodiversity or at least sound diversity in a set of recordings and so on. So you can do an awful lot with sound that you can't do with any other instrument that I could find.
We're talking with Michigan State University Professor Emeritus Stuart Gage, who is an ecoacoustician. Ecoacoustics is the study of the soundscape of the environment. And we're in the Ted Black Woods in Meridian Township, just off of Van Atta Road. Are we near a sensor that would tell us anything?
Well, we're relatively near a sensor. We'd have to go down into the at the edge of the interface between the wetland and the forest to look at one of the sensors. I have one in my backpack that I can show you, which is one I received from Australia. It's new to me, but it's fairly easy to operate.
Can you show me?
I will show you, sure. You can attach a microphone to it and turn it into an automated sound recorder. So if I open up the box, look inside, we'll see that it's wakened up, and it tells you I've got it programmed to record 48 times a day. So you can see on the screen it says next recording is going to be 7 o'clock in the morning.
That's about now.
So it'll start recording soon. And it has an SD card and a battery, and so it's pretty rugged and pretty reliable. So measuring 48 times a day, I'll get the whole gamut of sounds. Even though it's only a 1 minute long recording, you can certainly tell the difference between the time when the dawn chorus occurs and the time when the dusk chorus occurs, because there's a smaller dusk chorus that happens as well. And then we get into the middle of the day when most of the human activity happens. So I've got a fix on the time, which is fun for me to look at and analyze and so on. So I developed some metrics to be able to turn the sounds into numbers, and then each one of those values then can be plotted over this 48 times a day and averaged over a season, over a week, over a month, whatever.
I think we have company. That's an anthropogenic sound.
It is an anthropogenic sound, yes. They've the squeaking of the gate.
Do songbirds alter the pitch or tone of their calls based on the human environments? I mean, are there species that have been around for a long time, and when humans encroach, they either learn to adapt and call their mates a different way, or they leave the area because they don't want to be around humans?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And some birds with higher pitch sounds get drowned out by the technophony and can't really survive or live in a place that is maybe nice, but too noisy for them to communicate with each other. Of course, that's why they have evolved to sing during the dawn chorus, because that's when people are asleep and the wind is low and the sounds travel the farthest. So some species can exist in very urban environments. It depends on the species. Some species are more sensitive to others. Usually it's the higher pitched ones are the ones with the most delicate sounds that leave. The ones with the louder sounds or lower pitched sounds can survive near human habitat. So hence we get English sparrows and starlings and so on at the near human dwellings, whereas we don't see many warblers and some of the smaller, more delicate birds nearby.
Are birds the only canaries in the coal mine, or do you listen to frogs, the occasional coyote? Are there other animals out there that indicate the health of the ecosystem?
Well, I listen to everything, and birds are just one of the dominant features of the soundscape, but certainly there are wolves and coyotes, and even deer make occasional noises. They sort of bark like a dog when they get upset. And
but you can tell, though, from study, that if the pitch or tone or something of these animals is off, there may be an ecological health problem out there.
Sure, sure. And that's partly, you know, what I'm trying to study is whether or not the environment is a system, or whether we humans have broken it up into sort of pieces that don't fit together anymore.
Dr. Stuart Gage is the coordinator and secretary general of the International Society for Ecoacoustics, We have been scouring the woods in Meridian Township, listening to nature and learning what it has to say to us. Dr. Gage, thanks so much for this opportunity this morning.
Okay, Kevin. Thank you very much for coming out and spending an hour with me.
From deep in the woods of Meridian Township, for Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, members of the state's largest farmers advocacy organization are meeting in Grand Rapids this week to talk about their priorities for 2017. We'll hear what's on the minds of the Michigan Farm Bureau. Plus, as developments start rising in Lansing's Frandor Shopping District, an all-volunteer committee is raising money to create an area destination that will convey environmental stewardship through artwork. We'll talk with two leaders of Art in the Wild. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. I'm Mark Bayshore. We hope you can join us on Thursday. It's Current State on WKAR.